It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Childcare in Wisconsin is expensive and hard to find. At the same time, childcare providers are one of the lowest paid workers in the state. And now temporary federal pandemic aid for childcare providers is ending. Corrine Hess reports workers and families could face difficult choices.
When Diana Wells found out she was pregnant in 2018, she started searching for reliable childcare. And then she heard horror stories about potential providers in the Madison area being understaffed and unexpectedly shutting down.
And the cost was incredible.
Wells told her story at an event in New Glarus. While pregnant, she joined a year-long waiting list to get into Corrine's Little Explorers, which is owned by her sister-in-law, Corrine Hendrickson. But it's an hour drive from Wells' home in Verona. Now, her 4-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter are at Corrine's Little Explorers. She says her children are thriving, but to make it work, Wells had to cut back her hours as a teacher in the Verona area school district.
2 hours of my day is spent in the car when I can't be prepping for my lessons, I can't be grading.
Her story is not unusual. Childcare in Wisconsin is expensive and hard to find. A report from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association found over half of the state is in a childcare desert, with few available options. A separate report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found the average two-income household in Wisconsin spends 17% of their income on care for one child. For the last 3 years, Wisconsin childcare providers have been buoyed by a federal pandemic relief program that helped them improve pay for their employees while keeping tuition costs for families down. In June, funding for that program, called Child Care Counts, will be cut in half. Democratic Governor Tony Evers included $340 million in his state budget proposal to stabilize the program. So far, that funding remains intact, but it's seen as at risk as Republicans rewrite the budget. And preserving the funding is the subject of a statewide campaign among childcare professionals and advocates. Sean Fettaplace is with Main Street Alliance, a liberal trade group for small businesses. He says the future of childcare counts affects everyone.
If we don't get at least a good amount of funding to that program, I think you're going to see mass exodus of staff. And you're also going to see huge rate increases for parents, too. And I don't think that gets fully appreciated yet, just like how devastating this would be.
Even as the cost of childcare has risen, childcare providers themselves often struggle to earn a living wage. The average pay for the profession is between $7 and $12 an hour, making it one of the lowest paid occupations in the state, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum. But there's also a limit to how much providers can charge parents. Some families already decide to have a parent leave the workforce rather than pay the high cost of daily care. State data shows about 4,900 child care providers across the state received an average of $116,000 each through the Child Care Counts program. An October survey of Wisconsin providers found 60% will have to increase tuition when the program expires. Back at the New Glarus event, Wanda Legler says she spent her career in the child care industry because it suits her. But at age 70, Legler says she's fed up that the government hasn't done more to improve wages. She thinks it's because some legislators don't support careers for women.
A lot of these people making the decisions, they honestly feel that we should just be home, taking care of our kids. And I've seen it and I've bumped into it over and over and over again.
After several hours, the event wraps up with parents feeling grateful and providers hopeful. And right now, Diana Wells has figured out what works best for her family. But she's already starting to worry about next year, when her son starts kindergarten in Verona and her daughter is an hour away at a New Glarus daycare. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the U.S. Supreme Court establishes a more stringent test to determine whether federal clean water protections applied to a wetland, We explore what this high court ruling means for Wisconsin wetlands and developers seeking permits to dig up or fill protected wetlands. Join in with your thoughts on the ruling, your questions you have. Call in at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Evan Feinauer is a staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin. That's an environmental group working to protect Wisconsin's water, air, and natural heritage. Evan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Good morning. Well, set this up for us. How does the Supreme Court's ruling change the way that the Environmental Protection Agency regulates wetlands?
Yeah, so this is a ruling about the Clean Water Act, and the Clean Water Act covers what are called navigable waters. And the act further defines that to mean waters of the United States. And these are all these kind of big, vague terms. But what's really important here is that water of the United States in 1977, the act was amended to include adjacent wetlands. So ever since 1977, folks have been going back and forth about, well, which wetlands are adjacent, right? Because if a wetland is adjacent, it's protected by the Clean Water Act. And if it isn't, well, then it may not be. So this has persisted, this question has persisted across 8 presidential administrations. There's been a number of court rulings. And most recently, you know, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration, we're all promulgating administrative rules to try to define, well, which wetlands exactly are we talking about? What the court did last week was issue a ruling that broke with the understanding of which wetlands are protected across all of those 8 administrations, across 50 years, across all this case law. And they radically narrowed it to mean that the adjacent wetlands are protected are the ones that are have a continuous surface water connection with waters of the United States. So this is a big deal for wetlands because it, by some estimates, could cut almost in half the acreage of wetlands that are protected by the Clean Water Act. So that's what the court did last week. That's the sort of the big picture in terms of the impact to wetlands on the sort of national scale. Now, there's a lot of details there in terms of why the court ruled this way, and how it interplays with Wisconsin that are worth getting into as well.
Just the timing here, though, this decision, Sackett versus EPA, it comes just 2 months after the Biden administration has this new definition of waters of the U.S. rule that becomes effective under the Clean Water Act. So what could that mean for regulators?
Yeah, so this is going to be tricky for them. They're going to have to go back and make sure that they've got a rule that complies with this most recent ruling, right? Because any administrative rule that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency puts out has to be consistent with the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Clean Water Act. So the courts or the EPA is still going to have some flexibility to understand what this phrase continuous surface water connection means. And hopefully they'll do so in a way that protects as many wetlands as possible. But one of the challenges with this court's ruling is, you know, one of the main reasons they ruled the way they did is they said that the prior test, which was known as the significant nexus test from a 2006 decision. And in that, under that that approach, EPA had to determine whether or not wetlands had a quote unquote significant nexus to waters this United States. And Sam Alito, in his lead opinion for the court, said that was too vague and too confusing. Well, continuous surface water connection is pretty vague, too, and there's going to be a lot of work to figure out what that means. So what the EPA under the Biden administration is going to have to do now is do the hard work of figuring out, okay, well, which wetlands have a continuous surface water connection? And just to flesh out why that's a challenge, a lot of wetlands are seasonal. You know, during a wetter part of the year, they might have a continuous surface water connection, and in drier parts of the year, the water connection is below the surface, you know, through a berm or a mound or something. So they're still hydrologically connected and very much ecologically intertwined all year round. But because they don't have a literal surface water connection that persists year round, maybe they aren't protected, maybe they are. So this decision, for all its language about resolving the matter, really just raises a host of new questions as well.
Can you connect this to Wisconsin? How much of our state's wetlands could be affected by this ruling?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is interesting, and there's a few things to emphasize here. Wisconsin has a state wetland law that actually was enacted in sort of in its modern form about 2 decades ago after a 2001 Supreme Court decision known as Swank that also radically diminished federal jurisdiction over wetlands at that time. And what happened there was on a bipartisan basis, the state legislature stepped up and they improved and strengthened and expanded state wetland law to make sure that if the feds weren't going to be there to protect state wetlands, at least DNR could be. And so we still have most of that law. It's been whittled away and chipped at over the years, but people should be, rest assured that the state DNR still needs to give somebody a permit to fill in most wetlands in Wisconsin. Now, this ruling from the court still negatively impacts Wisconsin waters for a number of reasons, though. First is that in situations where a wetland was protected by state law and federal law, there was overlapping jurisdiction. And then DNR could get the benefit of Army Corps of Engineers and EPA expertise and assistance. This could be a particularly big deal for projects with large wetland impacts. So there's a proposed reroute of a gas pipeline in northern Wisconsin that's been proposed. That's going to impact tons of acres of wetlands. Well, having some federal expertise and resources to help with that can really ease the burden on DNR to map and understand those wetlands. That could go away if a lot of those wetlands aren't jurisdictional.
Thank you. I just want to pause there with that example. Thank you for that. Evan Feinauer, staff attorney at the environmental group Clean Wisconsin, looking at implications of the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling restricting the EPA's ability to regulate development in wetlands, and fielding your questions about the future of Wisconsin's water and your thoughts. The number to call in to ask a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A U.S. Supreme Court's ruling places new limits on the Clean Water Act. We unpack what it means for the preservation of Wisconsin wetlands and those that are adjacent to our state's waterways. Staff attorney at the environmental group Clean Wisconsin, Evan Feinauer, is our guide to the effects of the High Court's ruling and is taking your questions along the way. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Evan, you give the example of how this ruling could affect our state's wetlands, one being the disruption of wetlands with the proposed reroute of Line 5, the Enbridge pipeline project. So how are wetlands typically destroyed in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so people can request a permit from the Department of Natural Resources to fill a wetland for any number of reasons. And the reason does matter because there are different exemptions for certain kinds of activities, agricultural, commercial, what have you. But by and large, what you see is people requesting a wetland for some kind of development on land. And what the department's going to require them to do is to avoid impacts to wetlands where they can, minimize those impacts, and then mitigate for them by helping rehabilitate or restore a wetland someplace else. One of those permit exemptions that I referenced, though, is for non-federal wetlands. And I bring that up because, unfortunately, that exemption is going to expand automatically with the court's ruling last week. So one of the unintended consequences, so to speak, of having an exemption under state law that's tied to the federal definition of a wetland is that even though we have our own wetland protections, that carve out from those protections, which is one that we didn't and most environmentalists did not support, is now bigger than it was when the state legislature enacted it. So unfortunately, we can expect to see the non-federal wetland permit exemption be expanded and certain wetlands not be protected under either federal or state law. So that's another potential impact of this ruling. And that kind of gets into another part of this, which is just, we have all these state wetlands which are protected by permits, and that's great. And if the department has the resources to do its job, great, that'll protect a lot of Wisconsin wetlands. But that still won't be enough to protect Wisconsin's waters, because water doesn't understand or recognize or care about state boundaries. So, you know, we had flooding over in the Mississippi River earlier this year. Well, one of the main things that wetlands can help with is reduce the incidence and severity of flood events. So if Minnesota, for example, isn't doing what it needs to do to protect its wetlands on its side of the border, the water isn't going to go blame Minnesota and flow over there. So this issue of flooding, of water quality, of habitat for species, those are all issues that go across state boundaries. And so that's why having strong federal standards is really important, even if some states have good laws.
So to put a finer point on that, could there be more problems in wetlands near state borders if other states have weaker protections than Wisconsin?
Well, definitely. And if you think about some of our water resources, they're not just along borders on land where you might think of wetlands, but we have the Great Lakes system. Mm-hmm. And wetlands that are around the Great Lakes, particularly in northern Wisconsin, are critical, but they're just across the border from critical wetlands in Minnesota or in the UP in Michigan. So we're now a little bit subject to the whims of other states in terms of how well they're going to protect their wetlands. And that's going to impact our water resources. And that's unfortunate because it shouldn't be the case that if one state is doing a lot to protect its wetlands, which Wisconsin generally is, then we still suffer the consequences. And the other thing, too, is, you know, since this Wisconsin's wetland law was put in place a while back, all that's happened is every legislative session, there are efforts to weaken it.
And I want to pause on that note because there are some further questions on that. Evan Feinauer with us, staff attorney for Clean Wisconsin, as we talk about the future of Wisconsin wetlands after this new U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Clean Water Act. Let's bring in Jeff in Spider Lake. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
A question. So when, you know, they had the isolated wetlands Supreme Court decision, and in a bipartisan way, the legislature in Wisconsin moved very quickly to pass a state law that allowed protections. And then Minnesota, I believe, followed suit. I do appreciate what you're doing. And is that what we're going to do here? Is we're just going to pass a state law to protect wetlands further? We seem at the whim of the federal government all the time. So it's my question. Is that what we should do?
Jeff, thank you. Go ahead, Evan.
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I hope is that this ruling does give people the energy and the focus and the understanding of how important our state efforts are, and that we can't just rely on what's happening in Washington, D.C. to protect our natural resources. So that's a great example. So after that that decision about 20 years ago, we had a big bipartisan state law to protect wetlands. Right now, what we need is both efforts to strengthen the law and also really strong efforts to make sure that we don't weaken state law anymore. Because one of the arguments that people would use to justify weakening state law is, oh, well, there's federal law. Mm. And as we're seeing, that may not be there. And so we both need to protect what we have and, per the question, fight hard to potentially strengthen our wetland laws further. And I think that there should be energy to do that, given that we're seeing a rollback of protections on the federal level.
Let's go to Perry in Oconto. Perry, hi. What is your question?
Yes. How can the average citizen and probably people get together to strengthen these laws like you're talking about, or not weakening them further? Because it seems like you had mentioned, the Republicans are gradually degrading all our environmental laws, and we have this gerrymandering. So what can the citizens do? How can we get together?
So there are a number of things that can be done. Democracy isn't going to be an easy thing just to pull a lever and make happen. But if you can talk to your legislators that you care about wetlands, that does matter. Because you better believe that they're hearing from developers about how hard it is to get permits and how wetlands are just a nuisance. And now we know that's not true. We know that they're vital ecologically, and they need to hear that from their constituents too. The other thing is that science and research and education are critical here, because people do not understand how valuable wetlands are for habitat, for endangered and threatened species, plants and animals, flood issues to address flooding, water quality. They act as filters and sponges, and they do all these wonderful things for the environment. And sometimes people think of them as these little dismal swamps, right? And so the education and the science is critical there. And so just understanding that and spreading those ideas and then talking to legislators can be critical. And part of the way you spread those ideas is spreading those ideas with regular folks so that they understand the value of this. It's a little bit hard to talk about wetlands in general sometimes because there's so many different types and in different parts of the states. But a lot of people have seen a beautiful wetland somewhere in the part of the state that they visit and they care about. And the energy and that love needs to be translated into policy outcomes. And, you know, we can't change the composition of the legislature overnight. So we work with what we have. And one of the ways you can do that is by funding research and grants to rehabilitate wetlands, because that doesn't upset developers, because all you're doing is going out and doing work on the land. And so those carrots that can be offered and those budgetary items are great ways to help wetlands without necessarily irking folks who want to develop land out there.
Evan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Evan Feinauer, staff attorney for Clean Wisconsin, an environmental group that works to protect Wisconsin's water, air, and natural heritage. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about family song traditions.
Many of us grow up singing our family's favorite songs. They can carry a deeper meaning if they're rooted in tradition. For writer Jen Rubin of Madison, she's fortunate to have recordings of her grandmother's songs, tapes that were recently called upon during a family crisis.
When I was a kid, we always had shelves filled with blank cassettes. Sony, Memorex, TDK. We had them all. They sat in nice stacks, just laying in wait for me when my grandma called for me to bring her a blank tape and the tape recorder. I dreaded this moment. One minute I was splayed out on the couch watching sitcom reruns, and the next minute I was sitting next to my 75-year-old grandmother and her boyfriend Yakov, recording them while they sang the Yiddish folk songs. Now, I loved listening to my grandma sing. My grandmother leading our extended family in song during the Jewish holidays as she waved off anyone who tried to harmonize with her when she felt like it was her time for a solo, well, that was the best part of each holiday. But that didn't mean my 11-year-old self wanted her in my living room trying to get me to help her record her songs. They would sing a song, and I would stop the tape, rewind the tape, listen to their voices, and stop the tape. Rewind again, then start the process over. I never understood this. I mean, tape recorders were fairly simple machines in the late 1970s, and these were intelligent people that fled one continent and successfully made their way to another one. At the time, I didn't understand that she didn't really need my help. She wanted me to know the songs of the Jewish diaspora. My grandmother grew up in a shtetl in Russia in the early 1900s. When she was 16, her family fled attacks by the Cossacks and got on a ship to Ellis Island. As a young teenager, her job was to strap a sewing machine on her back, walk miles to town, sew for the Gentile family during the week, and walk home for Sabbath. Family lore has it that it was on those walks that she developed her beautiful singing voice, trading songs with the Russian peasants, returning from the fields, and the Jewish and Gypsy travelers. My first year living in Wisconsin, I decided not to travel back home for Passover. One night, as I was falling asleep, I realized it would be my first Passover without my grandma leading the songs. I was surprised by how bad that made me feel. I called my mom and asked her to get a tape recorder, sit down with grandma, have her sing the Passover songs, and express mail them to me so grandma could lead the songs at my Seder in Madison. A few years later, my grandmother died. And soon after that, we digitized her tapes. A few months ago, I got one of those texts you dread getting. My mom was in heart failure, intubated in the hospital, and it was touch and go. We all rushed to be with her in the hospital. Heart failure can affect breathing, so it was hard for my mom to talk, but she could text. One night, on maybe her eighth night in the hospital, she texted me. She wanted to know if I could find those digitized recordings of her mom singing. She was scared and in pain and thought it would bring her great comfort to have her mother sing her to sleep. At that moment, so many memories flashed through my mind, but it stuck on my sitting on that shag carpet with my grandmother, holding the Sony tape recorder. And now, 40 years later, those tapes were being called into service. I thought about how my mom had been the culture bearer for the younger generations, so we don't let assimilation remove our Yiddish heritage from our lives. And I thought of my mom, frail and alone in a hospital bed, yearning to hear her mother's voice. In a flash of technological finesse I don't usually possess, within minutes, I navigated on my phone to my Google Drive, copied the link to one of the MP4s, and texted my family a recording of Grandma singing. Then we were all silent for a few minutes, in our separate houses, but still together, listening to Grandma sing.
Jen Rubin of Madison brought us that story on the Yiddish tapes. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the floating scums of toxic blue-green algae blooms and why this algae growth is emerging earlier in the season on some lakes and waterways like Lake Mendota than in previous years. There's space for you to join in on this issue. Call in with a question or your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Trina McMahon is a professor of bacteriology and civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison, research aquatic invasive species. Trina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you. So glad to be here.
So Lake Mendota, largest lake in the Yahara River chain of lakes, you're studying the connection between some tiny invasive species and a bigger picture about algae blooms in the lake that we are all seeing and concerned about. Why study Lake Mendota?
Well, I'm not sure how many Wisconsinites know this, but Lake Mendota is famous worldwide because it's considered to be the best studied lake in the world, largely because researchers have been in the Madison area studying it since the late 1800s. And it's in all the textbooks. It's sort of the classic example of a lake that has too many nutrients in it and is really green.
Hmm. What discoveries then can you make when you have decades upon decades of data and monitoring and logging more data, like on invasives over a longer period of time? What does that enable you to do?
Yeah, that's one of our biggest strengths here, I think, with Lake Mendota. There are a few other lakes that we monitor in Wisconsin, but Mendota, like I said, is really the best studied one. An invasive species can take hold in a lake at any time. One of the things we try to figure out is why they emerge or invade at a certain time. But because it can happen at any time, you can't really predict and start studying the lake right before and then, you know, right after. So if you have a long-term study program, you can get, you know, the before invasion information and then, you know, suddenly the invader enters the lake and then you can keep studying it and see the impacts. Also, you're more likely to determine that the invader has arrived.
Naming a couple of these invaders, spiny water fleas and zebra mussels that you have documentation over like 15 years. How have the presence of these invasives altered the lake's water quality?
Well, that's absolutely one of the things that we are continuing to study, but we have enough data now that we're pretty sure that the first invader, the spiny water flea, or the combination of both have shifted the emergence of the blue-green algae blooms to start earlier in the season, at least in Lake Mendota, and possibly also Lake Monona. So those of you in Madison may have noticed that we had a bloom on May 22nd that is probably 3 weeks early compared to the historical record. And we think that that's due to the invaders changing the ecosystem, altering the food web so that the blue-green algae can get a foothold earlier than they usually would.
How significantly are algae blooms impeding how people interact with the lakes and the waterways, like for swimming and with pets?
Well, certainly it just looks gross when the water is super green and almost that bluish color, but it's actually not healthy to swim in water that has that color, because the blue-green algae are notorious for making toxins. And, you know, for a human, it really doesn't cause a lot of problems unless you ingest the water. It can cause a rash on your skin. But for dogs, it's especially worrisome because they tend to drink a lot of the water when they play in the water. And if they ingest enough of those blue-green algae, then they can have toxicity to their liver or their brain. And there are reports of dogs having seizures or even dying in Wisconsin pretty much every year.
Your research found a common toxic compound called microcystin is more often reaching detectable levels in Lake Mendota. And the number of days with detectable levels is rising by an average of 50 days each year. Why do these toxic conditions linger and for longer periods?
Well, that is something that we're trying to figure out. Our current hypothesis is that the food web has been changed. That the spiny water flea especially eats the organisms, the tiny animals that are also water fleas. Well, that's their common name. They aren't actually fleas. They're zooplankton. That we think the spiny water fleas are eating those native zooplankton. And so then they don't eat the algae. And so that just causes the proliferation of the algae sooner in the season, which, because they make the toxins, it means that the toxins are measurable in the water earlier as well. They also seem to be persisting later into the fall, which maybe doesn't matter as much for humans and dogs using the lake, but it certainly can impact the ecosystem. And that we're not entirely sure why. There's also, of course, climate change happening at in the background of all of this. And we know that as climate shifts in Wisconsin, we're getting different patterns of precipitation where the rain comes as, you know, larger, you know, slugs of rain. And then there's long dry periods in between. And so we think that perhaps that precipitation change is also contributing to the lengthening of the toxic season.
So many inputs here that could, you know, that are part of this, making it more of a complex problem. Why should researchers, though, pay attention to microbial communities and not overlook microbes and what is happening in the ecosystem?
Yeah, they do go a bit underappreciated, which is one of the things that I try to, you know, rectify, because I love them so much. They really are the base of the food web and carry out a lot of really critical services for the ecosystem. They recycle the nutrients, they provide food for the zooplankton, which then ultimately are food for the fish. And I think if we ignore them, then there can be big changes that go unnoticed that could have big implications later. And so the more that we watch them in our research, we think of them as kind of sentinels of change. So when we notice that the microbes are changing, that's kind of that's an indication that the ecosystem is undergoing some kind of shift as well.
We have UW-Madison bacteriologist and civil and environmental engineer Trina McMahon with us, putting these harmful algae blooms into context and the connection to invasives that she researches. Join in at any point. Call in with your question about water conditions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Madison bacteriology and environmental and civil engineering professor Trina McMahon on the causes of early season onset of toxic blue-green algae blooms on lakes, waterways. And there's time for your comments on water quality. 800-642-1234 is the number to call in. Let's bring in Paul in Madison. Paul, hi.
Hello there. This might be a little tangential, but it's my understanding that when the when Dane County takes the algae out of the lake, that they take it to the landfill, and that doesn't seem to be maybe the best outcome for that. I mean, is the stuff studied after it's taken out of the lake? I was involved with a program at one time in Madison to explore using the algae for an alternative fuel source. So I wonder if the researcher knows anything about that stuff.
Paul, thank you. Can you, Trina, fill in the blanks?
Yeah, the kind of algae that Paul's talking about are kind of the larger ones, almost more like weeds. And the they have these almost like weed whackers that cruise around in the lakes in Madison that pull out the big chunks. And it's true that they're very biodegradable once you take them out of the lake, and could be a fuel source. I think the logistics of that, of getting enough to make it worth it, and just moving it around, and all the water that's in it that you would have to deal with before you could burn it or do whatever you would want to do with it, I think just make it economically not feasible. That would be my guess.
Paul, thank you for that question. Chris now in Manitowoc. Chris, hi, what would you like to ask?
We're actually heading up north today to go fishing up in the Peshtigo Flowage, and spent a lot of time up north and down in Madison. And I see the difference that I'm wondering if the professor could comment on is up north you don't have as many lawns and farm runoff. So there isn't as many chemicals going into the lake from the neighboring community up north. And you see very,
Oh, Chris, I think we just lost you. But I'm wondering, Trina, I think we can get at the contrast Chris is seeing and the impact of runoff perhaps in different parts of the state. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the kind of textbook contrasts that we teach about and study is how a lake transitions from being clear and, what we might call a blue lake into something that's really murky and green. And that process is actually natural over many centuries, if not thousands of years. But humans accelerate that by the inputs that we mobilize into the lake. And that can be from things like deforestation, where the soil then runs off into the lake. But more often, at least in Wisconsin, it's agriculture and fertilizer use on lawns. The reason why that happens is because the nutrients, it's food for the algae, end up going into the lake. And so they just get just fat and happy on all those Big Macs that are coming into the lake. And they just grow like crazy. So if we can prevent all that extra food for them that is going into the lake, then it won't be as green.
I will forever remember that visual. But so is addressing phosphorus and runoff still the best way to reduce algae blooms? Where can we turn for solutions?
Yeah, this is a really hard problem. And it's difficult because once the phosphorus, which is the main nutrient that the algae need, once it's in the lake, it's really hard to get it out. And it just kind of keeps cycling around and around. And it's also difficult to shift the lake back to having more plants, which is actually kind of the alternative state that we see in more blue lakes, because the algae themselves shade out the plants. Mm. And so it's kind of a chicken or egg problem. You've got to get rid of the phosphorus, but you can't, and you can't really get rid of you can't get the plants back because the algae are shading them. And that's a pretty well studied phenomenon, especially, in Lake Mendota. But I think lake managers and researchers really don't have a good solution yet, other than just trying to get the inputs of phosphorus as low as we can, and then, waiting for the phosphorus to flush out.
Talking about invasive species and toxic algae blooms with Trina McMahon, professor of bacteriology and civil environmental engineering at UW-Madison. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You know, we just briefly mentioned climate change, but how much is climate affecting the chemical and microbial makeup of our lakes, which in turn could trigger some of the toxicity?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And the subject of a lot of what I'm interested in. I mentioned before, but I can talk a bit more about the changes in precipitation patterns, especially. So rain, when it falls on the farmland up north of Lake Mendota, or pretty much anywhere where there's farms near lakes, can flush the fertilizers into rivers or streams that then end up in the lake. And if that happens in the spring, especially when the ground is frozen and maybe, you know, some manure has been applied recently, we get an extra large dose of that phosphorus going into the lakes and rivers. And so the timing of that rain, so like when it comes and how big it is really important. And so some years we might not get a lot of rain in the spring and it's not so bad. And other years we get like just a huge rain event in like April. And that really sets us up for a very green summer. One of my colleagues in civil and environmental engineering named Paul Block has been studying the effects of really large scale climate oscillations on algae blooms. So maybe you've heard of El Nino and La Nina. Mm. He uses the surface temperature in the Pacific Ocean to forecast how bad the blooms are going to be. And it turns out that we are entering an El Nino phase right now. And he forecasts that the blooms won't be that bad this year, that they may have come early, but the intensity will be about normal. Well, and normal in the Yahara Lakes isn't great, but at least it's not going to be super epic. I think that's really interesting that you can take something that's happening, you know, thousands of miles
away.
Yes,
shows just how interconnected our water and systems and ecosystems are. I mean, that's phenomenal.
Absolutely. I think his research is really, really cool.
Well, Trina, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. I have so much fun talking about lakes anytime.
Trina McMahon is a professor of bacteriology and civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison, co-author of this study called Species Invasions: Shift Microbial Phenology in a Two-Decade Freshwater Time Series. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. You can find a link to that study at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Thank you.